This is a podcast from Deutsche Welle. For more information and a selection of other programs, click on to dwworld.de.
Deutsche Welle. Inside Europe.
Hello and welcome to Inside Europe. I'm Chuck Penfold in Bonn. On today's program, The Power of the Pen. Will a single letter bring down Rupert Murdoch's empire?
Clive Goodman alleges that in return for his silence, News International promised they would look after him. He alleges that other journalists were up to their necks in phone hacking at News International. And he also says that senior personnel knew full well what was happening. So these are very, very serious developments.
Also on Inside Europe, Turkey runs out of patience with a close ally. A record-high Swiss franc takes a bite out of Swiss cheese, and piecing together the past in La Serenissima. Those stories and more coming up on the program. The phone hacking scandal that has rocked Rupert Murdoch's media empire has flared up again. The long-running scandal took center stage in Britain last month. It emerged that journalists at one of Murdoch's papers may have engaged in widespread illegal invasion of privacy. New evidence now suggests that Rupert Murdoch's son, James, may have misled Parliament over the issue. And there's fresh embarrassment for Prime Minister David Cameron over the affair. From London, Stephen Beard reports.
The story began 4 years ago with a criminal trial. The royal correspondent at Murdoch's Sunday tabloid, The News of the World, was jailed along with a private investigator. They'd admitted hacking into the cell phones of members of the royal family. Murdoch's British company, News International, insisted at the time this was an isolated case, one rogue reporter at work. But now, says Member of Parliament Tom Watson, it's obvious there was phone hacking on an industrial scale at the newspaper, intruding into the lives of hundreds of people.
This is a very powerful media organisation who denied wrongdoing for many years, and it affected the lives of hundreds, if not thousands, of people. And I think it's my duty as a politician to get to the truth on that.
Watson is one of the most vocal members of a parliamentary committee that's investigating the scandal. Watson says the committee has new evidence indicating that Rupert Murdoch's son, James, may not have been entirely truthful when he appeared before the committee a month ago.
Parliament doesn't like being misled, and the reason we're doing this is so that we can get to the facts and find out what went on at the time.
The committee has just released a slew of letters that have come to light. There's one sensational missive to News International from the jailed reporter Clive Goodman. This is the smoking gun in this complex affair, says opposition Member of Parliament Ivan Lewis.
It's obviously a serious development. Clive Goodman alleges that in return for his silence, News International promised they would look after him. He alleges that other journalists were up to their necks in phone hacking at News International. And he also says that senior personnel knew full well what was happening. So these are very, very serious developments.
Other apparently damning documents have emerged. One indicates that both the jailed reporter, Clive Goodman, and his accomplice, the private investigator, each received the equivalent of around $380,000 from News International after they'd been convicted. Therese Coffey is a Conservative Member of Parliament.
As a former accountant and finance director, I think you should always follow the cash. The cash often leads to the truth. And within 6 months of that letter being written by Clive Goodman, he received over £200,000 in payments from the news group, and we need to try and understand why that is.
The implication is very clear, says former Deputy Prime Minister John Prescott, himself a victim of phone hacking. He says that News International was buying the silence of the jailed reporter and the private investigator.
Murdoch's business philosophy seems to be pay them off as much money as you can, deny the evidence, and then withhold information.
The evidence suggests that phone hacking was not only rife at the News of the World, it was openly discussed at editorial meetings. There's also further evidence suggesting that Rupert Murdoch's son, James, became aware of the widespread nature of the illegality much earlier than he'd let on, and therefore that he'd misled the parliamentary committee when he appeared before it last month. If true, can he survive as a senior executive in any British company? Stephen Glover, an influential newspaper columnist.
No, I don't think so. If that were established beyond all doubt, I think that would be the end of James Murdoch.
It may also spell the end of Murdoch's involvement in British newspapers, says Glover. The American-based parent company, in which the Murdoch family owns a large minority stake, makes most of its money from television and film. American-based executives and investors are getting restive, says Glover.
A lot of people in New York who don't like all this fuss, who don't regard the British newspapers as particularly important, and think that Mr. Murdoch has paid too much importance to newspapers.
Murdoch's already closed the News of the World in the wake of the scandal. There are many other potential casualties in the pipeline. The police have mounted a huge criminal investigation. And there's this man, Andy Coulson, a former editor of the News of the World, who's also denied before Parliament any knowledge of phone hacking.
I never condone the use of phone hacking, and nor do I have any recollection of incidences where phone hacking took place.
If the latest evidence is to be believed, that was a blatant lie and a huge embarrassment for the Prime Minister, David Cameron. He hired Andy Coulson as his spokesman after he'd resigned from the News of the World over the affair. Stephen Glover.
Even if Coulson turns out to be innocent, and he is innocent until proved guilty, I think we can all say that it was a bad misjudgment on Mr. Cameron's part.
Coulson resigned as Cameron's press spokesman earlier this year. He's now under investigation for, among other things, alleged perjury. The phone hacking scandal continues to grow. Stephen Beard, Deutsche Welle Radio, London.
The increasing crackdown by Syrian forces on the opposition looks set to claim another victim, namely that of a close ally, neighboring Turkey. Despite strong criticism, Ankara has for months been calling on the international community to give the Syrian regime time to introduce reforms. But Ankara's restraint appears to have come to an end. And as Dorian Jones reports, that could have far-reaching consequences.
With the Syrian crackdown intensifying by the day, Turkey's patience with its former close ally appears to have finally run out, as the Turkish Foreign Minister Ahmet Davutoğlu made clear on Monday.
Bu yaşananların herhangi bir şekilde insan hakları bağlamında sadece iç...
This is our final word to the Syrian authorities. Our first expectation is that these operations stop immediately and unconditionally. If the operations do not end, there will be nothing more to discuss.
Davutoğlu's ultimatum came after months of talks with Damascus, culminating in a seven-hour meeting with the Syrian President Bashar Assad last week. The Turkish Foreign Ministry has warned that Damascus only has days left before it loses Turkey's friendship. Turkish Foreign Ministry spokesman Selim Yenel says that even though Ankara does not believe in sanctions, it will nonetheless be prepared to fall into line with the international community. Yenel even refused to rule out military intervention in Syria to create a safe haven for Syrians.
It's difficult to think about that right now. We hope that it won't come to that. We're not thinking of it right now. And for this, of course, there has to be some kind of international decision. We will not act unilaterally. We'll abide by the international community.
Earlier this year, over 12,000 Syrian refugees fled Turkey after a crackdown on towns close to the border. Many have now returned. But with Syria's offensive intensifying, there are growing fears of a new wave of refugees. According to one European diplomatic source, Damascus is courting Syrian members of the Kurdish rebel group, the PKK, which is fighting the Turkish state. So there would be security advantages for Turkey in creating a safe haven along its border with Syria. But former Brigadier General Haldan Solmaztürk warns of major risks.
Militarily, it's quite simple. It's like bread and butter. But politically, it's unimaginable. The current situation, reality of the region, all Syria and Turkey, and the other, you know, multidimensional balance of power in the region, would never allow that.
Turkey's neighbors and allies, Iran and Iraq, observers warn, would strongly oppose such a move. And Turkish Prime Minister Recep Tayyip Erdogan is traditionally extremely cautious about foreign interventions. However, there is growing anger within the Islamic-rooted ruling AK party over Syria's crackdown, which is intensifying during the holy month of Ramadan. But Damascus shows little signs of changing its course, whatever the consequences. Dorian Jones, Deutsche Welle Radio, Istanbul.
A village of just over 1,000 inhabitants in central France is bracing itself for the arrival of 40,000 evangelical Christian Roma for a week of massive prayer meetings. As our Paris correspondent John Lawrenson reports, they're being met by protests.
Pastor Joseph Charpentier, Jackie to his friends, tells one of the families already arriving for next week's gathering where to park their caravan. By this weekend, there'll be around 7,000 caravans parked across 120 hectares of former army training ground, where tens of thousands of Roma have permission to hold their summer gathering. Pastor Joseph organises everything from the sanitation to the pitching of the huge stripy circus tent lent by a circus family, where the huge religious services and mass baptisms will be held. What we want is for this gathering to take place in the best possible conditions, he told TF1 television, and everything has been structured, all means have been used to make sure that the arrival of travelling people causes the least possible nuisance to local people. The caravan that has just arrived is typical for this sort of gathering. It's spotless, drawn by a similarly spotless white utility van with a Christian fish symbol bumper sticker. Around one-third of France's 300,000 or so gitans, or gypsies as they call themselves, have converted to a strict charismatic form of evangelical Christianity over the past few decades. Pastor Joseph, like evangelicals of all faiths the world over, is full of stories of how the Holy Ghost, as he puts it, has saved many of his community from lives of drink and violence, helping them towards better ordered, happier and more fulfilling lives. But, says Sabine Caplou, who is one of them, this does not seem to have altered the attitude of non-Roma towards them.
Là, on arrive de Troyes.
We just arrived after a long voyage from Troyes in eastern France, she said. We parked next to the main road with some other caravans because the site wasn't open yet, and all night drivers honked their horns to wake us up, I suppose. We're used to that sort of welcome. On the edge of the site is the pretty little village of Nevoix, where people view the now annual arrival of the Roma with a wary eye, to say the least. This year, the municipal authority has prepared for this week by blockading all access to municipal land. Jean-François Darnois is Nevoix's deputy mayor.
Voilà nos solutions, les solutions actuelles.
Here are our solutions, our current solutions, said Darnois, pointing to the trenches he's had dug along the side of some roads to stop gypsy families parking their caravans in places they don't have permission to park them. We've also laid down tree trunks and rocks to block some access roads and paths in order to prevent abuse.
Des exactions, on va dire.
What sort of abuse? Well, although facilities are good on the campsite proper, which is indeed clean and tidy, locals complain that around the edge it's much less so. Some also complain about the noise. John Lawrenson, Deutsche Welle Radio, Paris.
I'm Chuck Penfold in Bonn. You're listening to Inside Europe. Switzerland has a reputation for having a strong and stable economy, and its products are regarded as being of high quality. But Switzerland also has a reputation for being something of a high-priced island in Europe, which isn't exactly a bargain hunter's paradise to begin with. And now that Switzerland's currency has reached record levels against the euro and the U.S. dollar, Swiss manufacturers fear they're being priced out of the market. Imogen Folks reports from Bern.
So, with this hammer, we make the sound to hear if the holes in the cheese are big enough.
Cheesemaker Christoph Retz is doing his daily quality control.
And by hammering like this, you can hear the holes, how big they are, if there are enough holes.
A practice carried out in his family for generations. Emmentaler, the most traditional of Swiss cheeses. Still produced only in small local dairies, each wheel can be traced back to its own village. 60% of Emmentaler is exported, mostly to Europeans who until now were ready to pay for its quality, even though a Swiss Emmentaler costs substantially more than the mass-produced German imitation. But not this year. Christoph Retz is seeing his product priced out of the market by the strength of Switzerland's currency.
The worry is the strong Swiss franc. The sales are not too good. We lost about 17% of Emtal export. 17%, which is a lot. And it's, for the moment, it's a problem.
It's a problem that, as the franc approached parity with the euro, caused something close to panic among normally calm Swiss political leaders. Serge Gaillard is director of Switzerland's State Office for Economic Affairs.
The franc, the Swiss franc, is extremely overvalued. We had an increase of the value of the Swiss francs by more than 25% in 18 months. That means that the unit labour costs in Switzerland have increased by more than 25%. We export more than 50% of our products. We are losing our competitiveness. If the Swiss franc remained at this level, our economy is running into deep troubles.
Swiss producers face worrying choices. Absorb the currency fluctuations, take a loss, and risk not having enough to pay their overheads in Switzerland, or move production abroad, causing job losses at home, or raise prices in the eurozone and risk losing customers. For Professor of Economics Klaus Neusser, any one of those options poses dangers.
I think for the country as a whole, there's really a danger that the country is going into a recession. I mean, the export industry is suffering quite a bit. And I mean, the franc is just now strong, but it has been strong all the time. So still there's a great danger, I would say so.
So what can Switzerland do to curb the strength of its own currency? Serge Gaillard believes there's one very basic solution: flood the market with francs.
It's our currency, and it's up to our national bank to stabilize this money and to weaken the Swiss franc in order to make Switzerland again competitive. If people want to buy francs, which is anyway overpriced, then it's not so difficult for our national bank to offer these francs. The production costs are not very high.
And in fact, the Swiss National Bank has begun just such a strategy, but so far with only modest results. The franc has climbed back to just above 1.10 to the euro, still far away from the 1.30 Swiss manufacturers say is realistic. Professor Koisser isn't convinced the strategy will really work.
I don't know. I mean, it's going so quickly up and down. If you could think this is 10% in 2 or 3 days, it's amazing. And so it's very hard to make a forecast. I mean, 1.30, as some people think, is the right rate. I don't think we will see that.
So where does that leave makers of traditional Swiss products like Christoph Retz? He's pinning his hopes on a new marketing campaign to remind Europe just how unique his Emmentaler cheese is.
The best cheese in the world. It's produced really naturally, without artificial addings. It's produced by respecting nature and environment. Quality always has its place, and so we will survive, I'm sure.
All of you?
No, not all.
And so Christoph and many Swiss manufacturers will be watching the currency markets anxiously, hoping for some weakening in the franc, but above all, hoping that the price-conscious European consumers will still be willing to buy Swiss products. Imogen Folks, Deutsche Welle Radio, Bern.
And that report takes us rather nicely into our August quiz, because this month we're focusing on the Swiss franc and its record high against the euro and the dollar. Now, if you look closely at a Swiss banknote, you'll notice that it's in four languages, and we want you to tell us which four languages. If you know the answer, you can email us. Our address is europe@dw-world.de, or write us at Inside Europe, the English service, Deutsche Welle Radio, Bonn, Germany. We have 5 prizes to give away, and we'll announce the winners next month. Don't forget to enter, and good luck. Next week, the city of Venice will introduce a new tourist tax meant to raise money for vital restoration work. On average, around 60,000 people visit Venice each day. That wear and tear, together with rising sea levels, has put the city, known as La Serenissima, at risk. Restorers are constantly working to preserve its treasures and return them to their original splendor. Jean Di Marino visited one landmark where the work has been going on for decades.
In a workshop behind St. Mark's Basilica in Venice, two artisans restore priceless mosaics damaged by the high tides which flood the city.
This is a floor mosaic. It's the decoration in front of the entrance to the treasury of St. Mark's Basilica.
And how ancient is this?
This is ancient. It's a pavement that dates back to the 12th century.
Ettore Vio is the proto, the architect in charge of all restoration work at St. Mark's. There have been protos here for centuries. The city's main cathedral was built about 1,000 years ago. Millions of tourists travel here each year to marvel at its artworks and its 8,000 square metres of mosaics decorated in gold and other precious stones. But the monument, the symbol of a once powerful city-state, is crumbling.
The main enemy of the basilica is water. The high tides enter the atrium 200 times a year, even if only a little bit like this. So all of the masonry or stonework is soaked with water.
Vio employs 20 restorers, including 6 mosaics experts, to tackle the ravages that salt water and time have wreaked on the basilica.
The salt grows in volume when it crystallizes. When it expands inside the brick, it cracks the brick. So little pieces of brick keep falling down. If there's a mosaic over the brick, the mosaic falls too.
In the workshop, restorers pour over hundreds of tiny tessera, or coloured stones that make up the mosaics. Each is carefully arranged on a piece of fabric in a pattern that duplicates its placement in the basilica. Some tessera are cleaned and repaired. Every effort is made to preserve them. Only a few are replaced outright. Restorer Guido says each square metre of mosaic takes close to a year to return to its original state.
We took 7 years to restore the baptistery, reinforcing and cleaning it. We've been working on this pavement here for more than 5 years, probably 7 years. This is not work that you can hurry.
In Ettore Vio's 30 years as proto, his staff has restored various cupolas and chapels in the basilica. He says their most important task was the crypt beneath the altar, where the remains of St. Mark, the patron saint of Venice, once lay.
We injected resin into the walls to close all of the holes through which the water passed. Then we repaired the stonework and treated it so that it could exist with the least salt possible. The high tides came into the crypt. Now nothing comes into it anymore. It was 10 years of work.
But all their work may have been for nothing. Time and tide wait for no man. Floods in recent years broke all records in Venice. In 2010, high tides washed over Piazza San Marco more than 200 times, the result of an area of low atmospheric pressure. Experts say this year is better, but nevertheless, sea levels are still rising. And floodgates meant to protect Venice are years from being completed. Still, the restorers work on faithfully, trusting that their skill will be enough to keep ahead of the tides. Jean Di Marino, Deutsche Welle Radio.
And I'm Chuck Penfold in Bonn. This is Inside Europe. We'll be right back. This is Inside Europe, and I'm Chuck Penfold in Bonn. Coming up in the next half hour, the changing face of Russia 20 years after the end of the USSR.
The degree of inequality, the difference between richest and poorest is huge. It didn't exist during the Soviet Union, and now it's everywhere, and it creates very different psychological situation.
Also on the program, are immigrants bearing the brunt of Greece's economic crisis? The Portuguese score a hit with their drug policy, and why Tamil pilgrims have flocked to a small town in Germany. Those stories and more coming up. The attacks in Oslo last month raised fears that nationalist right-wing violence is on the rise in Europe, especially as the current economic crisis worsens. Many nationalist groups blame immigrants for problems like crime and high unemployment. This sentiment has found a voice in Greece, which is suffering through its worst recession in decades, while at the same time taking in many of Europe's illegal immigrants. The situation is especially tense in the capital, Athens, as Joanna Kakisis has been finding out.
It's a hot afternoon, and Afghan immigrants are gathering in a central Athens square called Victoria. A grandfather is selling stale bread to a young mother in a headscarf. A few young men from Kabul and Jalalabad sit in a circle near the bread seller. All came here with the idea that they'd find work, but they're all unemployed. Everyone back home told me that when I came here, people would take care of me, says Farhad Bakhteri, who's 25. But now he and his wife and two sons are all homeless. It's a sad story and one of thousands, but many Athenians are losing sympathy. They blame a big rise in violent crime here on immigrants. Police data shows that homicides and robberies doubled between 2009 and 2010. Tasos Boulis is the Greek owner of a kiosk in the square. He says he's been robbed several times and sees violence every night.
They rob houses, buses, trains, anything, and no one cares. If we complain, we're racist. I expect something awful to happen, like it did in Norway, because people here are under way too much pressure from this.
The fear of immigrants is turning some Athenians to Chrysi Avgi, or Golden Dawn, a far-right nationalist party that has taken up policing these neighborhoods, often brutally. Ilias Panayotaros is a Chrysi Avgi spokesman. He says the police are letting illegal immigrants take over Athens. If immigrants complain about having no work or money, he says, then they should just leave.
Then they should go back in their countries where they were nice and safe and they had nice jobs and everything was perfect in Pakistan, in Somalia, in Algeria and everywhere. So if they don't like Athens and they have such problems.
Chrysi Avgi won a seat on the Athens Municipal Council last year and Panayotaros says his party will be in parliament soon. Chrysi Avgi supporters were out in force in the neighborhood in May, shouting, "Greece belongs to the Greeks." The occasion was a memorial service for a Greek man stabbed to death by Afghans a few days before. In the riots that followed, gangs of Greeks attacked immigrants, and a Bangladeshi man was stabbed to death. Ahmad Babul, who's 29 and also from Bangladesh, watched as a friend was brutally beaten.
Suddenly, 8-9 people coming and beat him. And his eyes is broken, all blood is coming, two teeth is broken, and go hospital.
For now, life is calm in Victoria Square, despite the underlying tension. Every evening, Afghan children fill the place. A 5-year-old boy named Hamdallah is on his own because he says his dad's in jail. A 10-year-old girl named Donya sells packets of cigarettes. Orestes is Greek and owns the second kiosk here. He doesn't want to give his last name. Look, he says, I'm not against immigrants coming here to make a better future, but there are just too many of them. He says he feels bad for the kids. But these days he also feels bad for his neighborhood. It's turned into a ghetto, he says, with too many angry people. Joanna Kakissis, Deutsche Welle Radio, Athens.
Next, we turn to the trial of former Bosnian Serb military commander Ratko Mladic at the International Criminal Tribunal for the former Yugoslavia in The Hague. Mladic, who was arrested in northern Serbia back in May, is facing a series of charges stemming from the 1992-95 Bosnian War. Now prosecutors have asked for the trial against him to be split. They want to try Mladic for the Srebrenica massacre of 8,000 Muslim men and boys in one trial and deal with the siege of Sarajevo and his other alleged crimes in a separate trial. To find out more, I spoke to Aleksandar Kuntic. He's a legal officer with the prosecutor's office, and I began by asking him why they decided to ask for a split trial.
The prosecutor decided to do so from several reasons. First of all, the victims have waited 16 years to see Mladic in The Hague, and the prosecutor thinks that it is in the interest of justice that the proceedings against him commence as soon as reasonably possible. It is also a question of how best to manage the proceedings in the specific context of the Mladic case, and as we argued in our motion, for a number of reasons, including his age, we think that the best approach is to split the case into two trials. One would deal with the events in Srebrenica in 1995, and when that trial finishes, then the second one, which would deal with all other crimes charged in the indictment, such as siege of Sarajevo, crimes committed in the municipalities throughout Bosnia-Herzegovina, and crimes related to taking UN personnel hostage, would then commence.
So the Srebrenica trial will take place first, I understand.
Yeah, that's what is in the motion of the prosecutor. But I have to say that this is the motion by the prosecution, and now it is for the trial chamber to decide whether they would grant the motion or not.
Do you think by going with this strategy that you will have a better chance of getting a conviction?
We think that this would serve the purpose of a faster trial. That's what we think should take place. That's why we are asking the whole trial to take place in two separate phases.
Is this a strategy you've tried before?
No, this is the first time.
Okay, obviously you do have a need to try to speed these things up because they have drawn on, and in fact, Milosevic died in prison. I think the Karadzic trial's been going on for 20 months.
Yeah, that's true. But this has nothing to do with any other case. These are the specifics of the Mladic case. And the prosecution took into consideration different facts, and that's why we decided to propose this to the trial chamber.
Does the fact that some of his subordinates have already been convicted make it easier to get a conviction on him?
We hope so. And we also think that the fact that the events in Srebrenica took place within a relatively confined time period and geographic area, and the compact nature of the Srebrenica case, we think will facilitate more expeditious pre-trial, trial, and judgment phases of the proceedings.
Okay, so it's meant to speed up proceedings. Do you have any idea how long it could take?
That would be speculation on my side, even to say when the trial would start. In our motion, we gave an estimate of about 1 year for the Srebrenica part of the trial. But this was given exactly because it is the most compact part of the case. And that's why we are proposing to commence with the Srebrenica trial. But that estimate is definitely preliminary.
Okay, assuming this works as well as you hope it will, would you then consider splitting up the rest of it and, you know, talking about the siege of Sarajevo as a separate case,
no,
for example?
No, the proposal is to split it only in two, first part Srebrenica and the second part all other charges together.
Aleksandar Kuntic is a legal officer with the prosecutor's office at the International Criminal Tribunal for the former Yugoslavia in The Hague. It's been 10 years since Portugal decriminalized illicit drugs. They remain illegal, but consumption is no longer a crime. And the country's fight against drug abuse is not focused on abstinence, but on minimizing risks facing users. The policy has been praised around the world for helping curb drug-related diseases. But there are fears that Portugal's economic downturn could impact this progress. Cynthia Taylor has been checking out a program for drug addicts in the town of Gaia.
It's past 10 o'clock in the morning. Psychologist Mariana Oliveira and nurse Andrea Gild from the project Girugaia are running late for their first daily stop. Some patients have already called in, wondering where they are. As the van reaches its destination, around a dozen men are waiting on the pavement in a residential area. They come forward to get their daily dose of methadone. Manuel Fernando da Silva is one of the first to drink from the small plastic cup. He's been taking heroin for 15 years, but for the past two, he's been on methadone to reduce his drug addiction. But that's just part of the support he receives with his project.
They help me out with just about anything that I might need. Clothes, taking me to hospital to see the doctor, anything. Just recently I had a problem with the dole, and if it hadn't been for this team, I wouldn't now be getting that money.
Some 70 patients get methadone from the Jirugai event each day. The aim of the project is not to convince users to give up drugs, but to be conscious of health issues and promote public health. As psychologist Mariana puts it, the methadone is used as a bait to help these people further.
Many have very ambitious ideas to give up drugs, but sometimes they're not ready for it. But methadone gives them the chance to take small steps. And then, instead of worrying about how to pay for the next heroin dose, they'll start thinking about where they can cut their hair, have a bath, or get some food. From there, they might even start considering giving up drugs and take more control over their lives.
Some of the patients have had daily contact with the team for 8 years. The relationship between them is based on trust and respect. No judgments are made about the course patients choose. Maybe that's why a familiar face has reappeared. Antonio Gonçalves is trying to reduce his heroin consumption for the third time.
Let's see if I'm a bit wiser this time. It's all about your mind. It's not the addiction that controls you. I was foolish and fell for it again, for the third time. Let's hope it's the last.
At each stop, drug users can also exchange their used syringes for new ones and get clean utensils, such as a container to mix the drugs and a sample of citric acid to replace the lemon juice used to inject the drug into the veins. Each person who wants to join the program is obliged to undergo medical exams. In its 8 years of existence, Jirugaya has provided support to over 1,400 drug users in this region. It's also detected 160 cases of tuberculosis, which have since been treated. The project reflects Portugal's national policy that trying to reduce the risk is more effective than promoting abstinence. The new strategy came into force after the country decriminalized drug use 10 years ago. José Queiroz is the director of APDES, the organization behind the project.
As equipes de redução de riscos precisamente não colocam estas questões no eixo do bem e do mal.
The teams working on risk reduction don't see the issue as being good or bad. They don't see themselves as the good guys and drug users as the bad guys. They establish a relationship based on equality, and that's introduced a new value in society, respect for the drug user. From both a social and a health point of view, this is of great benefit to the user.
There are conflicting views as to whether the strategy has helped decrease the consumption of hard drugs, but it's widely believed to have led to a dramatic reduction in drug-related diseases. However, the economic crisis in Portugal could change these positive developments.
Definitivamente, o corte nos apoios sociais face a estes consumidores.
A cut in social benefits will definitely impact these drug consumers. Some of them have been receiving some sort of financial support, enabling them to pay for the room or apartment they've been living in. So a cut will increase the chances of them being back on the streets in a new, degrading situation where their dignity will be back to zero, and that could have dramatic results.
Back on the street, psychologist Mariana and nurse Andrea are wrapping up for the day. It will be some months before they find out how much funding there will be for the next year. But they're adamant that the project must carry on. Cynthia Taylor, Deutsche Welle Radio, Gaia, Portugal.
It's been 20 years since the old Soviet Union began to unravel, as rebel politicians mounted a coup against the then-president, Mikhail Gorbachev, while he was on his summer vacation at his dacha. While Gorbachev did manage to stay in power, at least in the short term, it was the beginning of the end for both him and the USSR. This week, Russians are reflecting on the two decades that have passed since then, which have brought great highs and great lows. Karen Percy reports from the Russian capital.
The summer of 1991 was like any other. Soviet citizens flocked to their countryside duchess to make the most of the warmth and the sun. But on August the 19th, while the Soviet president Mikhail Gorbachev was holidaying in Crimea, some of his deputies moved against him. The military were on the streets. Many people came out to watch, like physicist Yelena Mazel, a 27-year-old mother of two at the time.
I remember very well when I was in this crowd along the White House, and we waited for tanks. I was very afraid.
There was also excitement in the air. Mikhail Gorbachev's reforms through his policy of restructuring or perestroika and his push for openness through glasnost had created anxiety and uncertainty across the Soviet Union.
Maybe he was an honest man. He tried to do his best, but the idea was absolutely wrong. The idea was to create socialism with a nice face. It was absolutely impossible.
When it was all over, Gorbachev had survived, but his authority had been undermined. In December 1991, he stepped down, simultaneously dissolving the USSR. Many people were shocked at the turn of events, as Nikolai Petrov from Moscow's Carnegie Center explains.
Well, you can imagine that changes like these, are pretty painful. And the fact that there is no more a huge country, there is no more superpower, you cannot be proud of being a citizen of the country which is everywhere, which is well-known and which plays a very important role in world politics.
To this day, some Russians still cannot forgive Mikhail Gorbachev.
I would not say that it was his intention to bring the country to collapse, but anyway, it was him who cheered when this process was going on. That's why he's not very popular here in the country.
Boris Yeltsin succeeded Gorbachev and proceeded to introduce political reform. A multi-party system was developed. The media was freed up. People could speak openly and critically about the government and the bureaucracy. The West was shocked by his bizarre public antics, dancing or singing, sometimes seemingly drunk. But for Russians, he also brought shock therapy for the economy, rapid and extreme liberalisation. Price controls were lifted, and so inflation soared. Because wages did not keep pace, many Russians could not afford basic goods. A devalued ruble and corrupt banking practices wiped out the life savings of many people. At this time, a new class of Russians emerged, the oligarchs, who were well-connected and cashed up. They bought state-run companies at rock-bottom prices and took the vast majority of their profits out of the country. Ordinary people, shaped by Soviet conformism, could only stand by and watch. Here's physicist Yelena Mazel again.
We were unable to organize, to be together, to have some battle for what we need. We were too disorganized, too lazy.
Russia is still recovering from those days, as the Moscow Carnegie Center's Nikolai Petrov explains.
Moscow looks like any global city. It's very different from Russian province. And the degree of inequality, the difference between richest and poorest is huge. It didn't exist during the Soviet Union. And now it's everywhere, and it creates very different psychological situation.
Vladimir Putin has been steering Russia in one capacity or another since 1999, firstly as president and now as prime minister. A former KGB agent, Russians like his strongman persona, even if they're not so fond of the cozy relationship between his government and the business elite. Putin treads a fine, if not always clear, line with the oligarchs.
In our country, it's sometimes difficult to understand where business ends and the state begins, or where the state ends and business begins.
Putin can make or break businesses in Russia. He has levelled fraud allegations against Boris Berezovsky, an oil and media baron who now lives in exile in London after his television station criticised the Chechen War of 1999. Most recently, former oil tycoon Mikhail Gorkovsky was jailed for a second term for embezzlement, but it's more likely because of his political ambitions. Russians have little sympathy for the oligarchs who run afoul of Putin, and they seem mostly unconcerned that little by little he has been winding back democratic reforms. The Carnegie Center's Nikolai Petrov.
There is a kind of social contract, and the state does not intervene into private life. And this is, by the way, the major difference from the Soviet Union. Everybody can go out, can leave the country anytime, and there are no problems to do this. But another side of this contract is non-intervention of citizens into what is considered to be the state affairs, like, say, elections, appointing governors, and so on.
Early next year, an election will be held to determine the next president of Russia. Currently, the post is being held by Dmitry Medvedev, but Vladimir Putin is widely tipped to want to run again. If that's the case, most political commentators are anticipating a further centralising of power under Putin, who is sure to win. Over time, though, Nikolai Petrov from the Moscow Carnegie Center is hopeful that change will come.
Now there is revival of the interest toward politics. There is a kind of tiredness from the political system. That's why I would say that regardless of who is the next president of Russia, the era of Putinism is over and the country is coming to the next stage of its development.
Any change, though, is likely to be slow. While many people are glad to have said goodbye to the bread queues and the dead-end state jobs that existed 20 years ago, they are still uncertain about where modern-day Russia is heading. Karen Percy, Deutsche Welle, Moscow.
I'm Chuck Penfold in Bonn. You're listening to Inside Europe. More than a million Roman Catholics from nearly 200 countries are in Madrid for celebrations to mark World Youth Day. Pope Benedict XVI joined the festivities on Thursday. But just days beforehand, Europe hosted another religious pilgrimage. Thousands of Tamils from around Europe made their way to the German town of Kevede, which is located near the border with the Netherlands. It's an annual event and one of the largest Tamil pilgrimages outside of Sri Lanka. Joanna Impey went along and sent this report.
The sound of chanting reverberates over loudspeakers across the main square in the German town of Kevela. Turn the corner behind the church and you see where the sound is coming from. Hundreds of people have congregated for an open-air mass. These pilgrims are some of the thousands of Sri Lankan Tamils who came to Germany and Europe as refugees in the 1980s, fleeing the civil war in their homeland. The first pilgrimage to Kevela was back in 1987, when around 50 people made the journey. In the years since, the numbers have swelled to around 10 to 15,000. In the main square, long queues have already formed in front of the Gnadenkapelle, or Chapel of Mercy. The chapel houses one of the main reasons the pilgrims started coming here, the miraculous picture of the Madonna that has brought fame to Kevela. As they file past, some people hold up their children to get a closer look at the tiny copper plate print. Father Bennett Fernando, a Tamil Catholic priest based in Germany and one of the organisers of this year's pilgrimage, explains that the Sri Lankan people make a close connection between the Madonna in Kevela and a similar shrine back home in Madu.
Especially during the month of August, summer vacation time, a lot of people, they come together at Madu Shrine, we are in Sri Lanka, and celebrate. So after our people had been displaced from our country due to the past ethnic war for the last more than 34 years, so when they came here, they heard about this Our Lady of Kevalar here in Germany. Our Lady of Kevalar also have the background saying that this Our Lady, she has been protecting the people from the enemies of the war during the World War time.
And that reputation as a protector is significant for many Sri Lankan families in Europe. They come to seek help from the Consolatrix Afflictorum, or Comforter of the Afflicted. In honour of the occasion, they're dressed up in their Sunday best, women in jewel-coloured saris, girls in frilly party dresses, and boys in smart shirts and trousers. Father Bennett Fernando says the reasons for the pilgrimage are social as well as religious.
I think this is time for a people to come together for prayer, where they find inner peace, And also, on the other side, this is the time for the people to, for the social gathering. All the people who had been displaced from Sri Lanka, they live all around in Europe. Some from one family, two members, they are living here in Germany, another two living in Switzerland, and or some auntie, they are living in Holland. So this is for them an occasion to come together for the celebration.
And these pilgrims emphasize how important family is to them.
My sister's here, and my lot of relations are here. And we have to speak some little bit and then enjoy something.
I wanted to participate in this celebration with my relatives. So I came from London with my relatives here.
After the mass has ended, the pilgrims move on to the next important part of the day. Indian and Sri Lankan traders have set up a temporary market behind the Kevalar Basilica.
They're all different prices. No, all different prices.
Tell me what you're doing today.
We're selling saris.
And so you have a business in London and you've come all
absolutely.
The way out to Germany?
That's right, absolutely. Sorry, this one is 16 euros.
And do you come every year?
No, this is the first time.
And what do you think of it?
It's fantastic.
They're selling so many Indian foods, right? Rolls, vade, and mustard.
Indian Sri Lankan.
Yeah, Sri Lankan also,
Sri
right?
Lankan food.
Yeah, and some spicy foods as well. Mixer, and bakoda, and some mangoes as well, right?
Between the stalls selling clothes and food, you can find toys and other goods. Even small statues of the Hindu god Ganesha, with its distinctive elephant head. That's because a large proportion of the Tamil pilgrims who come to Kevalar are Hindu, not Catholic. They worship the Madonna in the same way as their Christian compatriots. Albert Kulin, a priest from the Diocese of Aachen, who's been closely involved with the Tamil community in Germany for many years, says all of them are praying for peace in their homeland.
Officially, the war is over since 2 years, but there's no peace. Probably in the last years of this war, thousands of people were killed. This is very hard, and I know each family who is here today has one of these relations, friends, or honor, who died in this war. This is a very strong feeling. So their feeling is also that the war is not over for them, because there's no peace.
Back in the main square in Kevalar, peace has descended after the long day. Thousands of candles flicker in the evening light as the pilgrims make their way home to all corners of Europe. Joanna Impey, Deutsche Welle Radio, Kevalar.
That's all we have time for in the program this week. Hope you enjoyed it. It was produced with help from Helen Sini and sound engineer Jürgen Kuhn. And I'm Chuck Penfold. Thanks for joining us. Inside Europe comes to you from Deutsche Welle Radio in Bonn. We'll be right back.
You've been listening to a podcast from Deutsche Welle. We hope you enjoyed the program. You'll find more information and podcasts at dwworld.de.